What we'd like to do now is have a panel of all the speakers, and this can be quite an exciting discussion, so let's go to it.
Can any of you comment on any studies being done in using Ibogaine for treating patients with chronic pain?
No, but obviously I'm with you on the idea of non-addicting pain medications, and Noribogaine definitely came into my mind early on, and we've been dialoguing with the Patent and Trademark Office about that idea. We have obviously some chronic pain patients that have come through our study, and again, anecdote is anecdote, but I believe that there may be some efficacy here, and obviously if we could get this into a patch or a depot or some kind of formulation, I think that would be really exciting, and it's something that I'm really intrigued with. But yes, we do have patients that we've detoxed that have chronic pain syndromes, and you know, you wait to see them come back and start complaining, I have a backache, I have this, I have that, you know, and of course that's going to, you know, really affect our response to the Ibogaine with their withdrawal symptomatology. I mean, clearly there are some patients who, you know, we've given Toradol to post-Ibogaine, we have, but there are some others that have had some severe disorders that, you know, looked really good and did not complain after Ibogaine, but more work needs to be done. I love the idea.
It's interesting that the clients themselves actually state they wake up one morning and they know Noribogaine is gone. We encourage all of our clients to go to aftercare. Those who go to aftercare clearly do better. Otherwise, Noribogaine wears off, whether it's lasting for 30, 60, or 90 days, depending on what type of hepatic metabolizer they are. They literally know when the Noribogaine has worn off. And we've seen patients who have complex medical pain problems. They've got two herniated discs with nerve compression. And during that period where Noribogaine appears to be on board, those pain conditions appear to be manageable with medications such as Toradol, ibuprofen, medications of a lesser degree. And as soon as the Noribogaine wears off, they want, you know, they want their Vicodin back. They want their narcotics back. So it seems to anecdotally have some analgesic effect to it.
Well, the analgesic antidepressant idea would put us right in the ball game for neuropathic pain syndromes.
By the way, in animal studies, Ibogaine itself has no analgesic effects, but it does potentiate the effects of morphine to produce analgesia. So there might be some rationale for why that might work.
You're saying Ibogaine, or are we talking about Noribogaine?
Ibogaine. Okay. Actually, Noribogaine has a similar effect, but it's more potent with Ibogaine.
Being a physician that is rather conservative and would abide by the adage of first do no harm, in our last review of Ibogaine at CSAM by Frank Vacci, the director of new drug development, while he was interested in the positive effects, my understanding was NIDA eventually did pull its support of Ibogaine because of the inability to control for the phenotypic variations related to the metabolism and then possible other side effects that they felt were really, in terms of risk-reward, much of a concern. So a statement like that from NIDA, I have to take that as some consideration. Do you have a response to that, or
I can? I'll take on that one.
Is there any updates? Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'll take on that one. Because we worked very hard with Dr. Vacci, and Dr. Vacci provided a lot of leadership for all phases of this protocol. And historically, I didn't. You have the JAMA article in your by Brian Vastag that's in your book, which has quotes from Dr. Vacci and gives you a historical feeling for this. In 92, we wrote the protocol to do the phase 1 clinical trial. Don't forget, the FDA reviewed all the data, and the FDA said go forward. The FDA said go forward. So they were convinced that we had addressed the issues of neurotoxicity that Stan talked about. That was a biggie. The other situation that was a big factor was the deaths. and there were several deaths that had been reported. And we worked very closely with the FDA to explain those and to show whether or not there was some unusual mortality or morbidity associated with Ibogaine administration. Again, the FDA was confident that we had done a good job and gave us the green light to go forward with an external data safety monitoring committee. We would not have gone down to St. Kitts if we did not have that in place. In terms of NIDA funds, and NIDA's portfolio, we heard the elegant talk today by Dr. Volko, NIDA funds a lot of different projects. To take Ibogaine, when we had the 95 meeting, the 1995 meeting was in March, and that was when the NIDA panels met, and there were many of us that participated. I think Stan was there. I mean, my God, we worked very hard on this. And basically, there was Dr. Leshner was there directing NIDA at the time, and there was a group of people who were called in as advisors to evaluate whether or not NIDA should fund the study. And again, whether there was enough evidence from Howard, basically Howard Lotsoff, because that was the only data that was there in human beings. So we had a neurotoxic flag raised by Mark Molliver's studies. We had anecdotal data from underground addicts helping addicts in outside of established medical centers with no validated data by, virtually no validated data by any physicians. And that's what we had, and that's what we took forward. We had humans who came forward and said, Ibogaine really helped me. And they provided testimonials. That's all we had. So at that juncture, it didn't seem like committing a large percentage of the NIDA portfolio to the study of Ibogaine was a good idea. And again, it's a Schedule I drug. But I think for me, I agree with you on the do no harm. And, but drugs do harm. And individuals who have tried and failed repeatedly the standard of care again and again and again and again, we've brought them in and we've seen Ibogaine turn around some individuals who have been chronic relapsers. I think we're going to see now what the FDA will do with the data set that I provide to them and whether or not, we can move something into the pipeline. My plan, our plan, our collaborators' plan is to request the FDA to allow us to mend the IND to bring Noribogaine into clinical trials.
And Dr. Certainly, one of the key issues here to safety is patient selection criteria. This is a cytochrome P450-2D6 drug. In the same way as physicians, we saw interactions between erythromycin and drugs like Seldane. When we use cytochrome P450-2D6 drugs in combination with each other, our patients undergo very extensive medical screening to make sure they are not on other medications, which may interfere with the effect of Ibogaine. And number two, that they are cardiovascularly stable enough to take this drug in the first place. We are not suggesting that this be given out randomly to anybody who wants to take the drug without proper medical screening. And I think, as with any drug we give any patient, whether it's in an ICU setting, no matter what disease we're treating, we look at that patient's history, and we evaluate a risk versus benefit. Every drug has a risk. But if the risk of dying from continuing heroin use is 10% and the risk of dying from Ibogaine is 1 in 10,000, certainly the risk-to-benefit ratio is there.
Well, we look forward to seeing whether it holds up to the IND or Phase 1 trial. So
thank you.
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Jean?
I have a question for Dr. Ron. First, I want to say, Dr. Ron, your talk really gave me a run for my money this time of the day. The caffeine from the coffee break really didn't help. The ice cream didn't help either. But I have a question about the possible mechanisms of action or the possible sites of action. From your talk, I gathered that the GDNF protein is one of the sites, that the ventral tegmental area is involved, and possibly the RET membrane protein. Is that correct? Does it have an action on the RET membrane protein? Or do I have that wrong?
I think you got that wrong.
Okay, just the two. Okay, thank you.
But Dorit, I'll follow up on that. Give us a little bit of a perspective about GDNF. I know you did this, fairly quickly. Where is it in the brain? How ubiquitous is it? Other places in the central nervous system? What other actions does it have? What kind of subtypes of receptors? Yeah, just tell us some more.
So there's a lot known about GDNF in association with the support of dopaminergic neuron, and that's why it has been actually studied in relation, for example, with Parkinson's disease. Not a lot is known about the acute actions of GDNF. Actually, there was just a study this year that suggested that GDNF inhibits a certain type of a potassium channel, which actually may have something to do with what we're studying here. But it is expressed in other brain regions. We do not see changes we didn't look at all the brain in all brain regions, but in the specific brain regions that we looked at, the increase was specific for the midbrain dopaminergic neuron that include the VTA. For example, there was no change in the GDNF expression in the hippocampus, for example. So I think that to put it in the perspective of this study, there is a lot known about GDNF and how it prevents neuronal cell death and apoptosis. I don't know if this is so relevant to what we're studying here. I think what is relevant to what we're studying here is what I mentioned, the Nestler study, which showed that GDNF does have opposite effect of what drugs of abuse do, to put it very simply. And how it does it, we have no idea. But we are now using mice models that have a reduced level of GDNF and the GDNF receptors to see if reduction of the GDNF pathway alter ethanol behavior in mice as we predict. I mean, but these studies are still...
In GDNF knockouts, you're saying that...
GDNF knockouts are...
They have less neuroprotection and are more likely to be ill with degenerative neurologic diseases?
GDNF is very important for the development of the nervous system. So GDNF knockouts are embryonic lethal. They're not viable. So we actually study the heterozygote mice. So,
Howard?
Question is specifically to Dr. Ron and any of the other panelists who might respond. First, it took me some years to come to an understanding of the language of behavioral pharmacology, and I'm completely lost on the language of Dr. Ron's presentation. But I would like to thank her because I don't think it's been stated, and Stan Glick or Deborah can correct me, in the animal model that ibogaine is neither reinforcing nor adversive. And I think that's a very important finding in the animal model because that's what we've seen in the human model consistently. The primary question, though, is are the findings of GDNF, which you are indicated in your ethanol study, universal to the areas of opiates and stimulants and other drugs of abuse?
I think this is a very important question, and the answer to it, I don't know. We are studying, we have to concentrate on one drug of abuse, so, and we are studying alcohol, and we just don't know.
Any questions, Barry?
Barry Rosenrid with City. Thanks so much for a wonderful afternoon. I know that today is mostly about the neurobiology and the sort of understanding the chemistry of this drug. What I'm curious about in terms of the follow-up of these patients, is there a separation between the people who do follow up in some kind of adjuvant recovery-oriented effort other than just this one experience down the road? And then B, of the people who do not succeed, what seems to be the issue? Because there's a couple of patients that I've had who where the ibogaine experience, everybody that I know that has participated in an Ibogaine experience, had a very powerful experience, not dissimilar from the kind of powerful experiences people can have in a treatment setting where they come in and they have this wonderful kind of an awakening and then don't do the work afterwards and then the awakening fades like a good experience. One man wanted to get into the biotechnology development of the Ibogaine and continued to drink and then called me about thinking about Topamax and to diminish, you know, looking for the next magic bullet. Another man who'd been through treatment a lot and had also a wonderful experience and has been to Narcanon, other, I mean, he's tried a lot of different things. It, you know, ultimately got sober, but it wasn't, I don't think, as a result of any one thing. So I'm curious about what you're finding there. And I get that it's out of the discussion of what went on this afternoon.
Well, I think you raise a very important point, and that is that Ibogaine is not a magic bullet. I think everyone in this room knows that. Obviously, you know, what we think it is, and I think what Howard Lutzoff said a long time ago, was that Ibogaine is an addiction interrupter. And, we've seen that. Now, having said that, you know, what's the magic formula for people? Because we've seen it all. We've seen, you know, people who have taken one dose of Ibogaine and stayed, we've got them clean and sober, and they're out there, and it's now since, you know, November of 96, and I had one just call me the other day, and he's clean and sober. So what was the magic formula with him? He didn't go into outpatient. He refused to go to the rooms, even though we told him he had to do 90 and 90. He had a powerful spiritual experience. You know, he wasn't brain damaged. He had some good socioeconomic indicators, and he had a family and a wife around him. And, you know, he went back into a supportive environment and used some other things as coping strategies. I mean, he didn't do nothing. He used Buddhism and some other things to help him along the way, and he did exceptionally well. Then you have an example. Let me take another one of this guy, MF, who's out here, Michael, who's out here in San Francisco, I should call him, who was a terrible heroin addict, really bad, and used a lot of black tar, and had failed all kinds of treatment, and had been on methadone and off and on methadone, and really tried, I mean, but couldn't get it right, and couldn't go to school, couldn't do anything. And he takes one dose of Ibogaine, had a little bit of a rough run on the island post-Ibogaine, but got through it. He had some psychiatric problems that we dealt with, nothing serious. He couldn't afford aftercare. We said, we actually got him scholarshiped for 30 days in aftercare. And then he went back out to California and has been phenomenal. He went to the rooms, he went back to school, and he's clean and sober 4 months. 4 years, excuse me. Now, going up on, will be year four this year. You know, I'll have Dr. Camlett, I'll turn this over to Dr. Camlett. Obviously, I think for some individuals, the wearing off effect of the NOR, you know, I think there is that, I get the sense that there is a critical window of opportunity and that there's an ability to engage these individuals and to get them to put together an aftercare plan that they're going to follow. There needs to be an aftercare plan in place, and there needs to be case management, and there needs to be some sociological support systems there that they can go back to. And if they do, they seem to do really great. You know, for some individuals, I would love us to be able to afford to be able to give them a second dose at 90 days. I think for some individuals, they need more than one treatment dose. It's just a scientific hunch on my part, because I think there's a good reason that chip is red at 90 days, and I think it has a lot to do with the neurobiological adaptations that Dr. Volko and others have elegantly demonstrated in imaging studies. And for some of our patients, depending on what other comorbidities they have, you know, they may need to have a second dose. I had another heroin individual, very severe heroin addict, who was also a bipolar. And I can tell you that two doses of Ibogaine set him straight. And this was a guy who failed every modality of treatment. I don't know, Barry. I think we've got more to do. But I think if we had the noribogaine to follow up, could we extend this window of opportunity and then, you know, have people become treatment ready, have them become more motivated, have them, you know, be more, have sort of the cognition enhancing piece of this so that they could get the cognitive rehabilitative piece of it when they are in treatment? Yeah, I think that would work.
So you're going to be tracking those behavioral parameters?
We're trying. I mean, that's, you know, it's the magic dollars and having the individuals to be able to do that tracking, but we're trying. And we're also trying to do post-hoc analysis where we look at other comorbidities and look at our treatment failures to see if we can get a better sense of what we could have done better for those individuals.
Barry, we tell all the clients when they come in, this is not a magic bullet. This is a window of opportunity where you can become teachable and feel physically well enough, where you can go to the meetings, you can go to therapy, you can find whatever individual source you want to teach you how to stay clean and sober on a daily basis, to fill up your toolbox with the coping skills you need to stay clean and sober. Certainly, without a doubt, the clients who have taken advantage of going to aftercare have stayed clean and sober for significant periods of time, which have been much greater than those who haven't, without a doubt. So we do encourage all those clients to go to aftercare. The interesting part is that the great majority of clients coming in, if we were to tell them before taking Ibogaine, we want you to go to aftercare, 90% or above would say, no, I've been there 10 times already, I'm not going. And after Ibogaine, the great majority say, yes, I'm willing to go. Something happens. A change takes place. They become amenable to treatment. And it's a remarkable change to see. Except, you know, they say when the student is ready, the teacher becomes a parent, and Ibogaine seems to do that.
Question over here.
Of course,
I have two simple questions. Number one, do we know how much of Ibogaine is actually converted to norIbogaine? Are there other metabolites or chemical entities may be involved? And the second question is, are you doing any studies with norIbogaine? And is your experience about the same?
Right. The we looked for other minor metabolites. This was work that was done by W. Lee Hearn in Miami, who's my collaborator. And we looked very hard, and we shared the data with NIDA. And NIDA looked also to try to see if there were any other minor metabolites besides norIbogaine that might have been, you know, active sites. And we couldn't find them. So it's a large first-pass effect. You see a certain, I can't remember the exact fractions of the dose that we recover in urine. I'd have to go back and look at my notes on that, but it's a very large first-pass effect. And again, Ibogaine is out of the blood in 24 hours. You don't see it. And if you look at the pharmacodynamic response to Ibogaine administration, very much the visualization phase corresponds to that rise of Ibogaine and the Ibogaine staying in blood, and then there's a shift and the visions cease and these people go into a kind of a acute phase of deep introspection when the norIbogaine levels are coming up and they go through the night. And then the next day, of course, norIbogaine is still in blood and it's very high in blood, and you know, they don't have any of the visualizations or any of the ataxia or any of the other things that we can associate with the parent. We have not yet put norIbogaine into humans. We wait for the FDA to evaluate all of our data and then to give us guidance on that. And once we're peer-reviewed, we're ready to get a GMP product of norIbogaine so we can begin those studies. In animal studies, however, we have data that demonstrates that norIbogaine will block cocaine self-administration, will block opiate withdrawals, and will block alcohol taking.
For those of you who don't make it to the workshop in the morning, I do want you to know that all clients go through a massive amount of laboratory analysis prior to taking Ibogaine. A complete review of their medical history, family history, a complete Axis 1 to Axis 5, an EKG, a Holter monitor, an echocardiogram, and when needed, a thallium or non-thallium stress test, and whatever other tests we deem necessary. While under Ibogaine, they have an intravenous IV infusion in place continuously with IV access with our own specific cocktails that we use. And they are monitored by a ICU-trained nurse continuously while they're under the effect of the drug as long, and the doctors are at their bedside also.
Last question.
Thank you. I just have a quick question. Have you been using Ibogaine long enough to see its effect in someone who's cleaned up from an opioid addiction, gets pain over 3 months, and has to go on prescription opioids?
No, we have not. We don't have any data on that.
Are you interested in going there?
for
that application?
I mean, yes, we are very, as I said before, we do have a pain application, yes.
Okay.
Great question.
Thank you to all the panelists. Thank you to all of you. We'll reconvene tomorrow morning at 8:30, and have a good evening.